More. More. Linoleum Knife presents More Linoleum Knife.
Crash!
What was that? I didn't even hear what you...
What?
What was the last thing you did? I didn't even hear it.
I did it in a very... More.
Oh, I see. Okay. It was not audible to me.
David Cronenberg's Crash premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 1996 and opened in the United States in 1997. Not that other one. This one.
The good one.
Yes.
We're here to talk about the good one.
The good Crash.
But first we need to talk about us for a second, because Some of you may have stumbled onto this thinking that you were going to hear Linoleum Knife. You kind of are.
Yes.
But what you are really hearing is another show that we do exclusively for our Patreon subscribers. For the people who subscribe at $1 a month.
That's right.
In fact, this is the cheap seats right here. You get a show that we do called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we take an older film that we love and want everyone to know about, and we talk about it for, 20 to 30 minutes, and that's what's happening here today.
That's
I'm Dave
right.
White, you're Alonzo Duralde, we are the hosts of Linoleum Knife.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we're we're distributing this freely out into the world is that at the end of summer, we take a couple weeks off, and then we give out the Linoleum Knife Summer Super Splash. Alonzo likes to refer to it as the Summer Super Splash Spectacular.
Yes.
He is incorrect, but we are here doing it. So you get to hear an episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, even if you are not a subscriber. And we are going to talk about a movie that, if we were doing this episode strictly for our Patreon subscribers, we would use the language appropriate to describe the actions of the film. But so here's what we're going to do. Because Linoleum Knife is a clean podcast that goes out on all the different
podcast
places
feeds,
and it's always marked as
clean,
we are going to describe the activities of the plot of Crash in the following way. Because it is a film about people who are fetishists who have joined essentially what is a cult that seeks to fuse the automobile accident with sexual intercourse, we are going to talk about automobile accidents as automobile accidents. And we're going to talk about what the people do to each other in this movie as crashing.
There you go.
He crashed her. She crashed him. He crashes her from behind with his mouth. Things like that. So we're going to describe their stuff as crash.
There you go.
And that way, everybody has a good time. In 1997, I started hearing about this new David Cronenberg movie that was coming down the road.
I mean, 96, like I said, that's when it premiered at Cannes. I'm sure
you're right.
It
was 96. Yeah, it was 96. And I remember having a conversation with you about this movie and the fact that it at Cannes had won an award for audacity.
Yes.
Like, that's not an award that they give out.
It's a special jury prize for audacity.
They don't just hand out the audacity award at Cannes. No. They had to make up a new thing just so they could give Crash something that they wanted to give it. And this did not go down well with the jury head, Francis Ford Coppola.
He
was unhappy about it.
Reportedly, much in the way of sort of foretelling the fate of this film in terms of being divisive, there were members of the Cannes jury who adored it. Coppola apparently was not one of them, and so they sort of rebelled and said, "We're giving a special award for audacity." And as Cronenberg would later tell it, Coppola wouldn't hand it to him. He got somebody else to present the award to him at Cannes. Mind you, its screening at Cannes was in itself a divisive moment in that, you know, as we often hear about screenings that take place at that festival, there were walkouts, there were boos, there was also lusty, sustained applause.
Yeah.
And so it would go.
And finally, it opened in the United States.
Yeah.
And you and I saw it at the AMC Glen Lakes in Dallas, Texas.
We did.
And I, if my memory serves, we were sort of seated in the middle of the theater.
Mm.
But it was a fairly full house.
Yes.
Because the hype machine right. had grown. You won't believe your eyes when you see this film.
And this was an NC-17 film after Showgirls.
Right.
Where there almost weren't any anymore.
Yeah.
But this was one where, like, nope, we are...
We're not cutting a thing.
We are honoring the director's vision.
Here we go.
Mind you, Ted Turner owned Fine Line, New Line at the time, and apparently part of the reason it was delayed in the States was he didn't like the movie either.
Right.
And thought it would lead to copycats, which, come on. Talk about not understanding the movie. Anyway.
So, we would see it. And we noticed quite a few walkouts.
Oh, boy, howdy.
And then, I don't know, a couple weeks later, right before it was finishing its run, because mm-hmm. it didn't stay in theaters very long.
Not
it was
very
not long. A huge, it was a controversy magnet, but it was not a huge box office success
yes.
in Dallas, anyway. And right before it ended, we went back to see it again. And this time we sat in the back just so we could
tally.
So we could count the walkouts. More than any movie I've ever been to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No question.
Yeah.
Because I think if you didn't know much about this movie, but that it was an NC-17 movie and that it was controversial because it was...
And it was full of sexy things.
It had sexy things in
right.
it. Yeah, this was... You very quickly were going to realize, oh, no, I'm in the wrong theater.
So here's what it's about. James Spader is married to Deborah Kara Unger.
Yes.
He is a man who makes TV commercials. Mm-hmm. His name, his character name, is James Ballard. James yes. Ballard is the name of the man who wrote the novel Crash, 1973. In the novel, he is also named James Ballard.
Oh, interesting.
This character.
Okay.
So, the first thing we see is Deborah Kara Unger.
Yes.
In an airplane hangar, and she is hiking up her skirt. And a total stranger is crouched down behind her, crashing her.
Yes.
That scene finishes. The next scene, James Spader is on the set of a TV commercial, and nobody can find him. And the reason nobody can find him is because he is in the
equipment room
with a production assistant. And he is doing the same thing to her that the man in the airplane hangar was doing to Deborah Kara Unger. But they're knocking on the door. Hey, come on. We got something to do. We got a TV spot to make.
Time is money.
He goes home. And he and Deborah Kara Unger exchange notes on their day's activities. And she says to him, "When you crashed, did you finish?" And he says, "No, we were interrupted." And she says, "Maybe the next one, darling." James Spader is then involved in a terrible car accident where someone else, the driver of the other car, dies.
No, the passenger of the other car dies.
Yeah, you're right.
The passenger
right.
of the car
the
flies
passenger.
Through the windshield
That's
and
correct.
Into his car.
The passenger of the other car dies. He is the husband of the driver. The driver is played by Holly Hunter. At the site of the crash, before James Spader is taken off to the hospital, Holly Hunter rips off her top, exposing her breasts to him. The next thing that happens, they're in the hospital. James Spader's in the hospital. Deborah Kara Unger is there to visit him. And she's crashing him.
Delicately.
He's very delicately because he's extremely
he's
injured.
Got a lot of pins in his leg.
So here's what we've got so far. Crashing, car accident, a horny car accident,
mm-hmm.
and then more crashing in a hospital. Apparently at an early screening, there was an audience, you know, there were audience that could like hand you notes. That
oh,
they had.
The test screening.
And an audience member... wrote on their note card, "Three sex scenes in a row is not a plot." Well, sure it is. If the plot is this, yes, then that is the plot.
If the plot is that no one is enjoying any of this, and yet they are...
See, I think they are enjoying it, but we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Okay. In the hospital, we meet a man named Vaughn, played by Elias Koteas.
Yes. We think he's a doctor at first.
Well, he looks like he's dressed like one.
Yeah.
But what he's really doing is walking around the hospital, taking pictures of car crash people, and checking out the vibe. Like, might you perhaps want to join my
cult
of people who fetishize automobile accidents and crashing each other in the context of an automobile accident? Turns out they sure are interested in that, and they begin participating in the group meetings where they watch car accident videos, in reenactment activities that are on the outskirts of town.
Can I pin in that scene?
Yeah.
There's a scene in that moment that very much... Ebert, in his review, talks about how this is a movie about a fetish that no one has, but it still approaches it as though it were a pornographic film.
Right.
And there's a scene... There's the moment where they're in the living room of Elias Koteas' house watching these tapes, and a tape malfunctions, and they want to put in another tape, and Holly Hunter's like, no, I have to watch this tape. This part of this tape is a thing, and it's that thing of people who get fixated on not just pornography in general, but on this specific, you know, film or photo or whatever that I have to see, because if I don't see this one, then the whole thing is ruined.
Right. So Vaughn comes along and he is covered in scars, face, torso, everywhere.
Yeah.
He is the most committed to the practice.
Do you know what the name for this fetish is, by the way?
I do not.
Symphorophilia.
Okay. Vaughn is the sexual magnet of this film. He is the one who's... Elias Koteas' performance is the one that risks toppling it all over.
Right.
Because everyone else's performance, the actors, is... Everybody else in the film, their performances are these flat, monotone...
Affectless.
Without registering the idea of pleasure on their faces. But Vaughn is practically licking his lips in every scene. He is seducing everyone he comes into contact with. It doesn't matter who it is. And when he meets James Spader and is sizing him up, it's the most homoerotic thing to be on screen since the new queer cinema about 5 years, 6 years earlier. There is a moment where you think, oh, those two are going to crash also in this movie that is not explicitly queer, although I have a queer reading, which get into in a moment. Events unfold, and they're also sort of non-events because they are explicitly cars driving too fast, intentionally trying to get into accidents that we then hope, we being everyone in the film, and then by the movie's midpoint, you too, the audience, you're like, oh, I sure hope they do crash. I hope they have a good accident and then good crashing at the accident. Like, you begin to root for them. Like, you want them to be happy.
You don't want them to take out any pedestrians or anything, but you just want their contained, you know, collisions to occur.
Yes. I'm not going to spoil what goes down, but there's some wild stuff that goes down, including what I would call the comic relief character of Rosanna Arquette.
That's fair.
Who also, like Elias Koteas, is delivering a performance kind of with her eyebrow raised. There's a scene, the funniest scene in the movie, and it's an intentionally funny scene as well.
At a Mercedes dealership?
Is at a Mercedes dealership where she is kind of grinding her body against the car on the showroom floor. And she is wearing a black leather outfit that would seem fetishistic among any sort of like BDSM person at a leather bar or event. She also has a full leg brace that She and walker, like a walker, canes that she uses to walk. And the car dealer comes up to her and says, well, can I help you with anything? And she says, I want to see if I can fit into a car that's built for a normal body. And she says it in a way that a person would actually say, would you like to do sex with me right here? And it makes the car dealer very uncomfortable. She tries to get in the car, and her leg brace rips the fabric of the material.
The leather.
And she is ecstatically happy. And then the wildest crashing scene takes place in the film after James Spader and Roseanne Arquette leave the showroom. And I won't talk about the way they crash, but they do so in a way that caused the most walkouts.
Oh, no question. Top of the list. Film. I want to go back to the scene, though, in the car dealership, because that scene works on multiple levels. On the one hand, yes, it is a total come on.
Yeah.
Also, when she throws out the term a normal person, it is that...
She says a normal body.
A normal body.
Yeah.
It is this moment of... In another kind of movie, that would be like an awkward comedy moment in that what does the dealer say to that?
Or it would be a reverse. It would be an ableist sort of, you know, attack on the disabled person.
Right. Or she's or a thing where she's saying it before anybody else can say it.
Right. But here she is actually fully commanding everything around her and telling the world, this is my body and you've made things that don't fit me, so I'm going to shove myself into it. I don't care if I ruin your stuff.
Her character reminds me of the performance artist Bob Flanagan.
Yeah.
Who's the subject of the documentary Sick. Yeah. Because she is wearing this like corset and the braces in a way that is necessary, but that she has turned into a fetish object.
Yeah.
Like one of the corsets she has like a space for an exposed breast that serves no medical purpose.
No.
It is clearly there just
for the fetish.
She's
there fully to take pleasure in herself and anyone else who wants to enjoy her.
Yes.
And now I'm not going to spoil the ending, but just let's let you know that Elias Koteas drives a convertible, a beater of a convertible.
And a specific kind.
Yeah, a 61 Lincoln. And he wants the end to come in that.
Yes.
He also wants a lot of other things to take place in that. And
they do.
Interview takes place with Cronenberg where he's like, when I was in high school, the guy with the convertible was the guy that was getting it.
Right.
So that's Vaughn. Anyway, what I love about this film, aside from the fact that it is super uncompromising and unrelenting and confrontational, where the car itself is this like sight of pleasure and terror, sometimes both at the same time, is that the people in the film are doing a thing that Cronenberg has long, or rather not. Cronenberg, from the beginning of his career till about the end of the 90s, was exploring the idea of how technology shapes bodies.
Yes.
Cars are not super sophisticated technology, but they're the one that we are involved with the most.
Yes.
And so...
And also the ones that are most likely to damage our bodies because of their use and...
Yeah. You know. So what you then get is, unlike the novel, which is all interior monologue on the part of James Ballard, you get a bunch of people who don't have interior lives that you could see or hear.
Right.
You are meant to understand them as people who want what they want, how they want it. And in that context, they are happy. Although you won't see them being happy.
Yeah, I mean...
They are pistons in an engine, they are, I think, fulfilling themselves. I don't think they're desperately trying to fill themselves with something. They might not always get what they want, like that near-death experience that also results in an orgasm, but they are super into keeping on trying.
Right. And yeah. And I think they're definitely indefatigable when it comes to the pursuit. But I think at the same time, the movie is they're sort of chasing a dragon that they're never going to catch.
Right.
And so that's why the performances are so affectless. Uh-huh. And the film itself is so chilly.
It is a shiny, flat, cold, gray surface.
Like it all those people.
That's my favorite mood and temperature, well, by course, the way.
All those people walked out of the theater because the movie didn't give them what they want.
It didn't give them heat or sex.
And this is a movie that is about people not getting what they want. Yeah. And designed in a way to not give you what you necessarily want out of this story.
If what you're looking for is hot, sexy,
yeah,
in the traditional sense,
right,
you're not going to get it.
No.
There's a lot of sex.
Oh, yeah.
Very explicit sex. But it's not going to give you the moment in a film that you normally see where people have sex and they move on with their business.
Right.
It's going to give you all of that. And that's all you get.
Yes.
And it becomes a way for the film to say to you, what is it that you really want? Here's what they want. What are you about?
I think this is also, and this is a weird connection that just kind of popped into my head. This is a movie that's in a way like John Waters is A Dirty Shame.
Right.
In that the idea of
without the yakety sax elements.
Right,
of,
exactly. It's not a dirty shame. It's not a wacky comedy. But I think both films take the notion of like, let's look at sexual proclivities that are not necessarily universally embraced.
Yeah.
They have a very specific, you know, sub culture of people that are into this as a way of portraying how all sexuality ultimately is kind of ridiculous. However vanilla you are, however fetishistic you are, this is what you look like when you're going after the thing that you want. And you may laugh at these characters or look at these characters askance or think there's something wrong with them, but we all have the thing that makes us tick, whatever that is.
Right.
And whether you are pursuing sex or are asexual, everybody has that thing, the pursuit that drives them.
Right. And that's, for me, the queer reading. Mm. It's sex for pleasure.
Yeah.
Not reproductive.
Nope.
Ever.
Not procreative in any way.
It's for community.
Yeah.
This is a community that's built, you know, that is encouraging of this particular kink. Right? It's not for anyone's approval. It's what the people involved in that community want to do because they are specifically horny for specific scenarios. You know, the Pride Parade might not want you, but you should be in the Pride Parade. I loved the idea of, I again, going back to an interview with Cronenberg, he's talking about the casting.
Mm-hmm.
Holly Hunter wanted in first.
Interesting.
Yeah. She, I don't think, even had the script yet. But she heard that he was doing it. And she was like, me. And he said, oh, yeah, sure.
Did you notice that she wears a white trench coat so that she always looks like a doctor, which is what her character is?
Yeah. Spader,
mm-hmm.
You know, who had already been, you know, a leading man-ish kind of person, but also sort of like a character actor, kind of villainous.
Right. Well, this is post-sexualized and videotape.
He's playing someone who's not a villain. But according to Cronenberg, he just wanted to know who else was going to be in the movie because he had to crash with all of them in the film. They did a lot of rehearsal. They did a lot of sitting around talking about what they would be doing in each specific scene because they are frequently just completely naked with each other.
Yeah.
Again,
I think this, you know, this falls into a category of quite a few specific fetishes in that there's hardly ever anything spontaneous happening in this movie.
Right.
These are couplings that are organized, orchestrated, choreographed because they involve machinery and people.
And Cronenberg talked about how he wanted the body movements of the characters to be, this is a quote, sexy, elegant, but awkward.
Yeah. Can we take a moment to talk about Deborah Kara Unger?
I was getting to that.
Okay.
Because for me, she's the queen of this
film. Oh, yeah. She's the MVP, no question.
She is, I was on the mic on a Linoleum Knife once. I said something that I think maybe people misinterpreted. When I said she's my favorite boring actress. And to me, that's not an insult.
No.
She has the power to be utterly glacial and make you want to watch every single thing she's doing.
Yes. She communicates ennui better than almost anybody.
And I think she gets the closest to the kind of person that this film is about.
Yeah.
She is the person that everyone, all the other characters in the movie should be emulating, because she's achieved the pinnacle of, I like it. And then she sort of evaporates, you know, like I love her in this film so much that without giving away the ending,
oh,
which is a beautiful ending and a happy ending, I say,
yes,
because she and James Spader are fully reunited. They are doing a thing that they are into and that they want to do, and they live in hope.
Absolutely.
It makes this film, maybe of many of Cronenberg's films, the one with the happy ending.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Up to that point, certainly.
So enthralling is Deborah Kara Unger in this film that you and I spent a good 2 weeks after seeing the movie just walking around our apartment talking to each other like this. No matter what it was. Would you like Fruit Loops for breakfast? Yes.
Maybe next time.
I would. And we misquote.
I know.
We've misquoted for 25 years. We
we kept saying, next time.
There's a recurring bit of dialogue where when things don't go exactly as they planned, Deborah Kara Unger says, maybe the next one. Maybe the next one, darling. And we kept saying maybe next time for yes. years and years and years. And even after seeing this movie like 3 times, we kept misquoting it. But we will never misquote again.
No.
Because it's wrong.
You're right.
To disrespect Deborah Kara Unger that way.
I wish I could send people to see a film that she made called Signs and Wonders.
Which is also great and impossible to see.
Impossible to find.
Impossible to find. Yep.
Strand released it for a hot second, and then it just poof.
It disappeared.
Like it never happened.
She and Stellan Skarsgård are in it.
Is it Stellan Skarsgård?
Yep.
I thought it was Gabriel Byrne.
He might be in it too. Who knows?
Anyway.
There's also, speaking of comedy moments, there's also a really wonderful bit where Vaughn, again, the ringleader of all of these people, he talks about what they're really into is the reshaping of the human body through technology. And you're like, oh, okay, so... You're the Cronenberg here. And then later in the film, he sort of goes, oh, that's a crude sci-fi concept.
Yeah, it's a thing I say.
That's Cronenberg winking at you.
Yeah.
So how is this both about death and not about it? How is it referring to the crash, you know, Le Petit Mort?
I was about to say, they call it Le Petit Mort for a reason.
How is this a transcendent and even religious experience for these characters? Because, I mean, it's a cult.
It is.
And it's a cult with rules, which cults have, but it's a cult that has sort of full freedom for its members.
I think there is this notion of being, of losing yourself to something that is larger than yourself.
Yeah.
And in this case, the thing that is larger to yourself is perhaps a 1961 Lincoln Continental.
Right. Which is why Vaughn wants a giant steering wheel tattooed on his torso.
Right.
And when he's getting the tattoo, he says, it's too nice and clean. Make it ragged. It's a prophetic tattoo. Yes. Another element of religious life. The
prophecy.
Idea of prophetic acts,
right.
You know. There is a reading of this film, in addition to the queer reading of it, as a religious film. And I remember a year or two later seeing Robert Duvall's The Apostle, which is equally rigorous in terms of what is going on in the film. And I remember coming home and you said, how was it? And I said, it's Crash, but with preaching and speaking in tongues.
I remember that.
And I hold to that opinion to this day.
What would Bresson say about the performances in this film?
Probably that they were acting too much. Oh, these people are trying to give performances, are they?
So, again, this film, not streaming anywhere right now, but there is a lovely Criterion Blu-ray that has come out. Long overdue, I think.
If you get it and you watch it and you want to throw it across the room, don't come blaming us.
No.
We're just here to tell you that we love it.
Yes.
So much.
I think 25 years later, this is a movie that a lot of times time passes and, you know, audiences warm up to a thing. 25 years later, this is still, you're either going to love this movie or despise it.
There's nothing to warm up to.
No. And that's the point.
I'll tell you this as well. For you and me, I feel like it's been sort of a bonding film over the years, because so often when it comes to cold, clinical, difficult cinema, mm-hmm. you and I can diverge.
Sure.
You and I often don't see eye to eye on a lot of that stuff. But we do here.
Yeah.
So, sort of, we are the James Spader and the Deborah Kara Unger of film critics.
I'll take it.
Ta-da!
One last question. What did anything strike you as being super 90s that didn't age well? Because I only have one thing, and that's the opening credits. The opening credits, which are designed to
look like... I love those
like,
opening credits.
Yeah, it's a cool idea. They're designed to look like the sort of lettering that's stuck onto a car that says like, you know, Galaxy 500 or whatever. But there's like a slight imperfection.
Yeah, and that's why I love them.
Yeah, but
because it starts, every word begins to warp and mutate a little bit.
Which is all, that's all well and good. But just
the animation itself.
The actual credits is very late 90s computer animation.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's the only thing in the movie. That and maybe Deborah Kara Unger's heels.
Oh, those stacked heels. Yeah, that you haven't seen those in a while.
But everything else is pretty timeless.
Yeah. It's a perfect film.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Crash, y'all. Crash.
We're done.
Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to hear this kind of thing throughout the year, where we delve into movies, most likely not NC-17 controversial titles, but, you know, we keep our options open.
We do all kinds of things.
Join our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. We hope you've enjoyed all of the Summer Super Splash Spectacular shows we've made available this week. An episode of Linoleum Nights, a Linoleum Knife and Fork, an LKTV, and now this one. We're taking the rest of the month off, so hopefully these extra episodes will fill the gap for you. We'll be back with regular Linoleum Knife free to everyone in early September. And
First weekend.
Same for all
when
of
y'all are
our
out doing your
Labor Day
whatnots.
Things.
We're going to be home anyway, so.
And then we'll be doing all these shows still for our Patreon, so if you aren't already, consider joining. Anyway, enjoy the rest of your summer, everybody. Drive safe.
Please do.
Yes.
Please do. Put your seatbelt on and observe the speed limit. Listen, when I'm in the car with you.
Oh, brother.
If I have to be the passenger, and I do not like to be the passenger.
Someone's got control issues.
I will say that you, I'm just going to put you on blast here.
I know.
You follow too closely pretty much everyone, and you need to be, according to driver's ed rules, one car length behind the car in front of you for every 10 miles per hour of speed you're going. Yeah. So if you're behind a car that's going 40, you need to be four car lengths behind. You don't do this.
Thank you, Grandma.
Which is why I drive the car.
And I enjoy when you drive the car because I don't have to put up with your nonsense as a passenger, because you're the worst passenger on earth.
AKA the best. I'm very helpful.
Until next time. Goodbye.